Welcome everybody, thanks for turning up to the last in this summer series of Digital Classics Work in Progress seminars. I'm particularly pleased that so many people have turned up, given that the Institute for Classical Studies library is actually being closed for a week, so we're technically outside of library time, so that's great. The Digital Classics seminars are sponsored by the Centre for Computing and the Humanities at King's College London and the Institute for Classical Studies here in the University of London, who provide the room and the snacks and drinks. The Digital Classicist, which organises and sponsors the seminars, is an organisation and a community, more than anything else, of good practice and collaboration in the study of the ancient world and collaboration with especially computer science techniques and cyber infrastructure and so forth. So that's been the focus of this seminar series. Just a reminder that we're recording the seminar for a podcast, which should appear online at the beginning of next week. So two things to bear in mind. One, that anything you say during the question session at the end of this will be recorded, so try not to say anything too controversial that you wouldn't like to have attached to your name. If anyone does anything really terrible, we can always remove it, but we'd rather not have to go to that trouble. And the second thing to bear in mind is that the microphones are at the two corners of the room, so if you're sat right by those corners, you don't need to speak particularly loudly when asking a question, but if you're sat very far away from them, then you may need to speak up a little to be picked up by the recording. Likewise, rustling of crisps and biscuits right next to the microphones will be more disruptive than elsewhere. Okay, so this week's seminar is presented by Peter Heslin, who teaches at Durham, and about 10 years ago came up with this this piece of software, Diogenes, which I remember hearing about at the time because I was working at the TLG then, and so it was particularly interesting to see a tool which, unlike most of the tools that were available at the time for reading the TLG and related disks, were either very expensive or didn't work very well. This was a tool that was neither of those things because it was free, and it did work well. And I remember in the fairly early days trying to install Diogenes on a Mac, which before then all of the Mac users I knew had been using Pandora, which has never worked very well in OS X, the later versions of the Mac operating system. And there was a certain amount of technical expertise required to get it working. I remember giving up after about 2 days. But it's now, in the more recent versions of this are great. They will install so easily, even on Mac and Linux and whatever else, that you can just give someone the URL. I pointed students toward this and said, just download Diogenes and use it, and they have. Even more impressively, I pointed professors to it, and they've also been able to do that. That's great. So Peter's going to talk to us today about the Diogenes tool, past development, and future plans.
Thanks. I was going to take a historical approach rather than telling you what the software does. You can just download it for free and try it out yourself. It's about 10 years old from the very, very, very beginnings. It's been about 10 years. And so I thought that I would look over how the tool evolved and rather than simply giving you a historical narrative, try to draw some morals from that, some things that I've learned that might be applicable to other humanities computing projects and the like, because at 10 years old, it is a fairly ancient piece of software, given the way things change in the world of computers. So I'll be talking about some nitty-gritty details, but I hope that the general principles and morals that I'm going to try to draw from it will be more generally applicable. So there's a timeline down the left-hand side there, which will run from 98 to the present, and then we'll finish up with some considerations about where Diogenes could usefully go in the future. So back in 1998, I was using Pandora to access the PHI Latin text and the TLG Greek text. I don't really do documentary stuff, so I never really had any need for the Duke documentary papyri and the inscriptions disk, but I did use literary texts. I've actually never ever tried anything else since then, so I don't know what those other expensive programs did because I didn't have the money to try them, but Pandora was always what was available in the universities I was at, and it was a pretty frustrating experience to use. I couldn't install it on my own computer because at that stage I was using Linux and it wouldn't work there. When you wanted to do a search, usually meant going off, you know, making a cup of coffee, maybe even having a sandwich and coming back and finding the answer. And it also meant that you had to find the CD, which, you know, usually the one you want wasn't there. So you'd have to go from the library to the computer room, wait for the one computer that had Pandora installed, find the CD, put it in, have enough time to run the search. And it meant that you didn't do searches very often. So I could never find the disk. It was too slow and it didn't work on Linux. And so I kept thinking, God, there's got to be a better way of doing this. And so what I did was I took the disks home, which, you know, probably not supposed to do, but I did it anyway because I was so frustrated one day after spending the whole day trying to do a search. Took them home, used the Unix utility grep, which is a simple text searching program, and I got the answer I wanted not after 15 minutes, but after about 15 seconds. And I thought, there's no intrinsic reason why this needs to be so slow. It helped that I'm a Latinist, so I was searching Latin text, so there was no confusion about this weird encoding of the Greek that you couldn't really read. It also helped that I work on poetry, and poetry has a pretty straightforward citation scheme. There's usually something that says book 3, and then you just count the lines thereafter, and that's a citation. There's no chapters, and most importantly of all, when we come to searching, there's no hyphenation in poetic texts. So I got started using texts that you could actually profitably manipulate without any specialized software. So for a while, actually for this whole year, when I was writing up my PhD, I was doing an awful lot of searching of the Latin text, of Latin poetic text, using a tool that was never meant to do anything other than search English texts. What I discovered over the course of that year, occasionally I needed Pandora because it was a prose text or a Greek text, and I didn't really know how to deal with those, is that Pandora has some bugs in it. For example, having discovered that hyphenation was a real problem, how do you search for a word given that the texts are represented on those databases in hyphenated form, you've got to do a bit of trickery to join the two bits of the words together on the fly while you're searching. And in fact, I discovered that Pandora doesn't catch all hyphenated words. And I started wondering, why is it that people are always saying, in published work, I'm telling you that there are only two examples of this word in Greek literature. They don't tell you what program they used to search. They don't tell you that they double-checked it by using two different search programs. They just present this as a result without telling you how they got that result. Well, given that it's not straightforward, some of these questions to ask of the databases, surely you need to double-check. You need to document your sources, how you arrived at those conclusions. And I started to think that maybe it might be useful to write a program that one could use to double-check Pandora's results. And I thought, well, if I write a better tool, everyone will flock to it. And that's the first moral to draw, which is that everyone didn't flock to it. Well, for one thing, it was very hard to install. It was actually always easy to install on Linux, which is what I used, but not a lot of classicists were using that. And they're also pretty conservative. So it's taken about 10 years for Diogenes to build up a large constituency. And there are thousands of people using it now. So if you stick around for 10 years, eventually even classicists will come around and start using your tool. Another moral to take away is that we all know this, but visual markup as opposed to semantic markup is truly evil. The whole source of the problem with hyphenation is that these texts were represented exactly as they appeared visually on the page. If a page ended with half a word and a hyphen, that's how it was represented in the databases. That is not how you should record them for a computer. You should record the meaning of the text rather than their visual appearance on the page. This was presumably originally done to keep proofreading costs down. So you could have people who didn't know anything about Latin or Greek comparing the printed text to the computer's output, and that makes it easy going in, but it makes it a lot more difficult to make use of those texts on the other end. So the first steps then were just this Unix tool called grep, which is a search tool, and a few bits of programming around it. So I created a little script that would show you a few lines of context of the word you were searching for, would tell you the author. And this worked for poetry. There's a little Perl language, computer language, that I used. And as I say, for about a year, it worked fine for me. Eventually got to the point where it could give you, if you guess at the line numbers, because poetry is so simple and straightforward, it would just run through the text and count the number of lines rather than using the built-in citation information. but usually within two or three lines it was accurate. You couldn't rely on it, you know, if you're going to put this in your PhD dissertation, and as I was doing, say this is on line such and such, you'd actually have to go to the printed text and check it out. But for searching, it worked really well, and what I discovered is that you can, if a search takes a couple of seconds rather than all day, as it was taking me, you can ask a lot more different types of questions. You can ask questions, let's just find out the random question, and do it right at your fingertips, and then you start discovering interesting things about words and about usage that you wouldn't have discovered otherwise, unless you're lucky enough to have something like the TLL on your shelf, which as a poor graduate student I certainly didn't have. I added a rudimentary browser so that you could, if you had a citation, you wanted to look at that citation, you could spot it. Again, this only really worked for poetry at that stage. And then I started adding Greek output. This is before Unicode, before anyone was really using Unicode. So it used this really peculiar encoding, which I was using for my PhD dissertation. It was a font called Ibicus for the LaTeX typesetting system. But I started to realize the limitations here and to started to wonder, what was this citation info that was embedded in the text? In other words, for prose texts and for all texts, there were these bits of information saying, this is book 2, chapter 5, line 3. But it was all in binary format. It wasn't something like XML where you could look at the text and say, oh, well, this says line equals 1. And it's pretty straightforward to understand what that means. This is all in a very peculiar binary format. And I started wondering what that information was and if I could get at it. And so still, this is probably about 99, I started thinking about, well, I wasn't really thinking about it, but just started doing it, reverse engineering this citation information. It's a state machine, which means that you have to remember what state your text is. So I'm at chapter 3, line 4, and then the next piece of information just tells you increase the line number, increase the chapter number. So there's no redundancy built in. You've got to have a computer that keeps everything in mind, and as I said, encoded in binary to reduce size, because these texts go back to a time when computer memory was very, very scarce expensive. So originally, this information, I was told by someone emailed me, who was involved in the building of those original Ibicus minicomputers. I don't know if any of you actually used those, originally this had specialized hardware, if you think that someone actually built a minicomputer that was designed from the hardware level to deal with Greek and Latin, the thought of someone doing that today is a bit bizarre. But this explains why the citation information had such a strange compressed format. But after a while, I had a eureka moment, which was that all of these texts were divided into 8 kilobyte chunks, which is not very much by our standards, but it was presumably all that you could fit into memory back in the days of these little Ibicus minicomputers. And at the beginning of every chunk, that state machine resets the state. So there's some encoding saying, we are at such and such a point in the text. And that was crucial because it meant that you could get a lot more information out of that. Instead of having to go all the way through a text and figure out all these little changes of state, you could just jump in the middle, grab the beginning of an 8 kilobyte chunk and say, okay, where are we in this text? And it would give you all of that information there. So that was how I was able to reverse engineer it, by looking at the beginning of those 8 kilobyte chunks. And it also suggested that you could decode this robustly, because the problem with the state machine where the computer remembers where it is that if it gets confused, that confusion has the potential to carry on and to get bigger and bigger and bigger as you make more and more mistakes. But if you reset every 8 kilobytes, well then any confusion is going to be limited to that chunk of text. And so I thought, well, this is something that I could actually work with. So what I did was to start peering at dumps of the text. This is the beginning of Cicero. And you see here, these first two lines, this particular program for dumping that raw data in hexadecimal format, just prints dots where you have something which is not ASCII, which is not straightforward Latin alphabet text. And so all of that information there is setting up that state machine to tell you where in the citation scheme you are. And then you'll see those dots reoccur sort of at the end of every line. Those dots are not full stops for punctuation. They represent another bit of binary data, some of them, after the C, dot for Gaius is obviously a real dot, but here at the end of lines, you get little binary updates at the end of every line. So after staring at that for long enough, and for comparing it with what I knew about the text, I started to figure out how it worked. What I did, though, the title of this slide is Worse is Better for a Reason, was to do things backwards. Instead of starting out knowing how the citation scheme worked, I already had a pretty functioning browser and search program, which I then had on top of it. I bolted on this citation decoding, which is not really the way you should go about it. You should go into something knowing how everything works and designing it all together. This is a bolt-on. But, and I'm jumping ahead here chronologically, someone else later on actually had the specification and tried to do it in Perl the right way, and he sent me the specification, and this is how it reads. Read in all bytes with assigned bits get that set, that's the binary data. This is the ID for the first record. Call a subroutine to decode the ID data. Now read in all bytes with assigned bit unset, that's your Latin text or Greek text. This is the text of the first record. Call a subroutine to process the text. Repeat this process for all records in the block, that is until blah, blah, blah. So this is a specification that doesn't describe how the data is laid out, but it tells you how to program your application. Now, we know nowadays that's not what a specification for data should do. So SGML had a lot of assumptions built in about how you're going to process the data. XML said, we're not going to do that. You can do this by reading the whole document into memory and then manipulating it, or you can just manipulate it on the fly. We don't care. That's up to you. That's up to the programmer. This is a bad specification because it tells you how to process the data. It turns out this is a great way to process the data in, what, the mid-80s, early 80s, when those Ipicus machines were being designed. Input-output was very slow, and computation was relatively cheap, especially if you could design your own hardware to do it that way. But for a modern architecture, that's a disaster. The idea that you're taking this data in tiny little sips and doing tiny little manipulations to it instead of reading it in all at once as a fast modern computer can do. Well, the guy who sent me this specification had tried implementing this in Perl, and it was incredibly slow. Incredibly slow. It was as slow as Pandora was back in the bad old days. So what I had happened onto was a better way of doing things because I didn't have the specification. I didn't know what I was doing. So I, by not having those instructions, I wasn't able to follow them, and this is some technical terminology, that approach in that specification may work well when your main constraint is that you have slow input-output, so your process is I/O bound, but it doesn't work very well when your main constraint is that you're processing, your CPU is your main constraint, because the balance had shifted in between the days that Ipicus was the state of the art. This is all driven by the citation info. In other words, the people who made this data were very concerned about the citation info, and so the whole thing is driven by decoding that. But why do you want to decode? If you're searching for something, say, that turns up in Cicero's De Inventione, why do you care about all of the citation info in his Brutus? There's no reason you should care about that, because your search term isn't there. So you can't ignore that if you approach it the way you're supposed to approach it, but the way Diogenes went on to approach it, that's the way it worked, because we only look at the search the citation information for the places that we like. I've gotten a bit too technical here, but the reason why I ended up doing it the wrong way, which turned out to be the right way, is that searching for text is a more general problem and has had more resources thrown at it rather than decoding all of this weird binary data. Hardware has gotten faster, much faster input-output, and much faster memory. So already at this time in the late 90s, you could usually fit in a full, even the biggest Greek authors, the biggest text is about 32 megabytes, I think John Chrysostom. That would already fit into memory. Nowadays, of course, the entire TLG will fit in memory, which means that you only have to read it off your disk once, and the rest of the operations can all happen in memory. So changes in hardware, also changes in software. There are various algorithms where you can do fast searching, as long as you don't worry about all of this business of decoding the binary data while you're at it. You just ignore all of that stuff. So I think a lot of other software may still be doing it the wrong way, because it's the right way. It's what the specification tells you to do. I mean, I remember looking at the website of an expensive piece of search software that boasted that it had some bits coded in assembly language for speed. The rest of it was done in C, and I think that must have been that decoding of the citation info. But no matter how fast you do it, you're still not going to be able to do fast searches if you're not taking advantage of all of the hardware and software improvements that have made the general problem of searching so much faster. So the moral there is, when you're dealing with a closed corpus, you do better to ignore the specification. If you're not going to have new text added, which might do different and strange things, if you're dealing with a closed corpus, just look at the corpus and work with that, and who cares about the specification? Because parts of it may end up having been irrelevant. Some text may have done something other than what the specification says, which in fact turned out to be true. I actually got more accurate results when I ignored the specification and just dealt with what was in the texts. So a perverse moral there, some may think. So at that point, still in about 99, I had a little bit of help. On the nascent internet, I found someone's code, computer code, written in C for the MS-DOS platform, which implemented some of these features. I never got it to compile. I didn't have an MS-DOS machine to work with it. But just by reading the code, I was able to figure out some of these odd TLG features, which I wouldn't have bothered about myself being a Latinist. Some of these obscure TLG features didn't matter that much to me. The genre of particular texts, the TLG encodes all of that. So I was able to figure that out fairly easily since I had someone else's code for doing it. The word list, also at that point, I was able to figure out. Now here's a sort of pseudo-moral. I should have ignored the TLG word list. The TLG had a word list to help make searching faster, but again, that's a problem that quicker hardware will make irrelevant. I mean, you don't really need a word list in order to search, so I spent a lot of time dealing with working with the TLG word list properly, and I thought this would make my code more robust. After all, the TLG understands its corpus, so if I am able to find the number of hits that I'm supposed to find of this word in this particular text, because the TLG tells me I'm supposed to find that number of hits in that particular text, it'll show that my code is robust. But in fact, I mostly ended up discovering that the TLG, in fact, had lots of errors in it, in their word list, in the citation info they had with their word list. And so I ended up having to try bug-for-bug compatibility. So I found bugs in the TLG, but because I wanted to come up with the same results, I emulated the mistakes that the TLG had made. And that was all probably not worth doing. And as I say here, this code is a nightmare and I don't understand it anymore because it's all trying to replicate bugs that I had found in the TLG's word list. I probably should have just, at that point, had the foresight to say, it's only going to get faster. Let's just not worry about the word list. Or, if I need one, create my own, because that way at least they're my bugs and not someone else's bugs. I did decode the genre information, the date information. This author comes from such and such a date range, which is probably worth doing, a useful feature, but some of that information is more useful than others. So the moral here on this slide is that you shouldn't assume that you need to support all the features in the specification. Some are obsolete and are speed-up hacks. So this word list really was just something to speed up searching at a time when hardware was slow. Just because it's there doesn't mean you necessarily have to support it. Then the web came around. We're still a long way from a Diogenes that has been distributed, but I started thinking about that, started thinking, well, if I'm going to distribute this, probably a Unix command line tool, which is what it was at the time, is not going to be widely useful for classicists. So I started thinking, how else am I going to be able to display this data? The web is one way of doing it. And so first refactoring of the code, I separated out the command line aspects and the core functionality into a separate module. And then I wrote this CGI script, which is a web script for presenting a front end to a browser. But at that point, very few browsers supported Unicode adequately, if at all. HTML layout was always done using tables rather than style sheets. And they're slow because you have to wait for the whole page to load. And the main method of displaying Greek that Diogenes had at first was as images generated on the fly from PostScript, which in turn was generated from LaTeX, which is incredibly complicated. Probably no one but me actually understood how to use this feature. And so I really hadn't made great strides towards making a tool that the general community of classicists would be able to use. Again, this is not waiting for things to come around. I should have just waited for browsers to support Unicode properly, waited for style sheets to come in, and then done it right. But instead, I decided to do something that would work on my computer at the time, which it did. This LaTeX output, another bit of code I don't understand anymore, had rather beautiful output, I think. And this is the point when I distributed first to the public. Most classic support groups don't have good tech support. No one used it because it was so complicated to install, as Gabriel has attested. Do not assume other people will install other software. This depended on the Apache web server, it depended on LaTeX, it depended on GhostScript, it depended on another piece of software to turn the PostScript into an image. It was all very complicated, but one good moral is that the web was a good choice of interface, even though I screwed it up the first time round. And here is some sample output. It was really quite pretty. This is from Ascolia Vetera to the Iliad. Unfortunately, the HTML rendering has never caught up to that level of sophistication because I was working with HTML4, which wasn't able to do this. I only maximized the features of HTML4, and I've never gone back to rework that code. We'll come to that. That is one future project which I want to get back to. But anyway, I think that looks rather pretty, even if no one but me was really able to use that bit of the software. So then around the year 2000, I really started using the web as the front end because now we had Unicode output for Greek. And while I was adding Unicode, why not add other encodings? Again, a bad decision. I should have just gone with Unicode, even though most browsers couldn't support it properly yet, and binned everything else. I could have made this encoding converter a separate standalone application that would have been much cleaner, because it's a nightmare dealing with the way different Greek encodings will conflict with different ways of formatting the text. So for example, in HTML, the a right angle bracket is an important code point. It's an important character. But some Greek fonts use that to represent a rough breathing. And so you need to protect one from the other. And that's fine if you've just got one Greek encoding, Unicode, and one mode of representation, HTML. But when you start having multiple possibilities for both, they can interfere with each other in myriad ways, which are impossible to predict unless you actually try all the different possibilities. And so that really complicated the code unnecessarily. So I should have just gone with Unicode and maybe written a separate application to output in other, to convert that to other encodings. We should have just had HTML and Unicode, only two things to interfere with each other. I did add HTML output at this point, but CSS, cascading style sheets, was not really supported widely in browsers, so I ignored it. Another bad decision. The moral there is to embrace emerging standards, even if they're unsupported in the hardware and software that you're actually using. You have to have faith that standards will out in the end, and even if that means having software that you can't fully test at the moment because your own computer won't support it, that's the way to go. Because you just end up wasting your time with obsolete technologies the other way. Other moral in application should do one thing well. Various Greek encodings is different from searching the TLG. Those are two separate things. Just because I could combine them into one program doesn't mean it was wise to do so. So about the year 2000, I did add some new functionality that was actually useful, searching for multiple patterns of text. So look for these two words within the context of one sentence or one phrase or three lines, and to use subsets of text for searching. So I only want to search in these authors or these works. That was all added about then. By popular demand, I added support for the DDP disk, the Duke Documentary Papyri disk. I don't use it myself, so is it still buggy? I have no idea because I never actually use it. I've just responded to users' complaints with that. It's not something I use myself. At this point, I refactored the code again. I made the code object-oriented, which doesn't really make any difference, but it did make it easier to document, and I actually wrote documentation. And the only time I've ever documented any of the code was at this point, which is a good thing, because at this point, lots of it I wouldn't understand myself unless I had documentation that I wrote in 2000 to explain it. So the moral there is adding core functionality. Core functionality, not this extra bells and whistles, is good, and so is documentation. So it was at this point, the following year, 2001 to 2002, that I was finally sent the documentation on the binary citation info, and I discovered that I had stumbled upon a fast way to do searches by ignoring the correct way. Using that information, I did make some changes. I fixed the browser to take advantage of some speed-up indexing, which, actually, after I spent all this effort of implementing it, actually slowed the browser down. Again, changes in hardware architectures means that something that was a speed benefit in the mid-70s in 2001 is no longer a benefit. It actually took more time to decode the indexing information then was saved by jumping to the particular point in the text, because input-output had gotten so fast in the intervening time period. So another moral there, what is a speed-up in the 70s isn't necessarily a speed-up in the 21st century. I rewrote the stop encode in the browser. When does a browser know that you've gone past the citation you were looking for? You don't want to just go to the end of the text. You want to be intelligent about stopping. That made it slightly more correct in some odd cases and substantially slower. I don't know if that was a win situation or a lose. So the moral's there. Someone else's optimization from the 70s might not be your own. And I think probably in the end it's better to be fast and 98% correct than slow and 99% correct, because that stopping code for the browser still isn't perfect because some of the texts don't abide by the specification. And it's a lot slower now. So I would say probably that was a lose rather than a win. At that point, I added links to the online Perseus morphological tools, which were a bit of a nightmare because, as we know, the Perseus site is not always the most reliable in the world. I hope there's no one for Perseus here. I think even they admit that. Also, they would change their interface occasionally, which meant I had to make changes. But in the end, I think it was a good thing to do. Coptic support, because people have been asking for it, not that I use it. And something that I added at that point was due to the fact that at this point, 2001, 2002, OS X for Mac was just kind of emerging, maybe 2001. Most classicists, I think, are still not using it, even if they can use either one. They're still sticking with the old OS 9. But now that Apple has a kind of Unix-based operating system, all of a sudden it looked like, well, I can easily port this to OS 10. It actually comes with Apache, and so I can use that. Well, why not add Windows? But how do you add Windows? There's no Apache for Windows. So I made this small step of adding a dedicated server, so that removed the dependency on Apache. Mainly I just did it to allow Diogenes to run on Windows, but in fact it was a much cleaner solution all around. So since then, very quickly, I told people not to bother running Diogenes under the general purpose web server Apache, but rather just use the special purpose one. So that's a place where porting something to a new platform actually improves it on the platform you originated from. And so at this point, Diogenes is heading in a platform-independent mode, but it still is only really easy to install on Linux. So in 2002, the basic features are complete, and so I said version 1.0, why not? It supports, as far as I know, all of the features of the databases, but it was hard to install, and this is what Gabriel saying. I mean, and I acknowledge that. It was a nightmare to install, except on Linux, where it was all very easy, but no classicists were using that, except for me. So it really was kind of a moot point. So the rest of the development, well, much of it was aimed at solving the problem of making software that's easy to install on three very different platforms, Windows, Mac, OS X, and Linux. And I made some wrong turns, once again, so that's some more morals to be learned in the next phase of the story. So I'm jumping forward to 2005, mainly because I didn't do much development in the intervening time period. My first book came out in 2005, so that'll tell you why there's a big jump there. And what's happened over those years is that more and more Apple-using classicists are moving over to OS X and discovering they can't use Pandora anymore, and so they're trying to install Diogenes. At the beginning, even very technically oriented people had difficulty. And as you get more and more people who don't have a clue, then the situation's getting to the point where we're getting lots of emails from people saying, I can't install it. So something's got to give. I've got to change something. The first change I made was to add the extra Perl modules that Diogenes uses so they didn't have to be installed separately. And that was the first step in a direction that I've gone to a very large degree now. Originally, I started off with the Unix philosophy of just have one simple tool that does one thing and have people install all the other support bits themselves. And that works fine for a technically sophisticated user, but for the other kind of user, much better just bundle everything together. What does it matter if it's redundant if you end up having three copies of Firefox on your machine? Disk space is cheap. Disks are getting bigger all the time. Just bundle everything together and make it easy to install rather than to have all these separate steps that you need to go through. I skipped over one nightmare problem, which is that when OS X was first came out, 10.0, I guess it was, 10.1, the version of Perl, the programming language that Diogenes is written in, was broken. And so you, even though in theory you should have been able to just install Diogenes straightforwardly, it would sort of work, except then randomly crash. Crashes that weren't my fault, because Apple had distributed a broken version of Perl. It wasn't my fault. And people come and say, this program crashes all the time. It's your fault. And so Things got better gradually. Now, for example, the Windows distribution of Diogenes includes Perl with it. Just throw the kitchen sink in. Don't make people have to install things separately. Just put it all in. It's a few extra megabytes on their hard drive. Who cares? Bandwidth is cheap. Disk is cheap. So these are the first steps in that direction, as I realized that you can't actually rely on the fact that OS X has Perl installed because it's broken. So let's add our own version. So moving away from a Unix mentality towards an ease of use mentality, the big problem at this point is that many users couldn't fathom the idea that you have to start the server first, which is Diogenes itself, and then you have to point your browser at it separately. So there's two steps that you need to do, and non-technical users couldn't quite understand, even though there was bits of Apple script that would do it for you. But the moral here is that for non-technical users, a big or massive simple bundle is better than having to install many small, discrete, efficient, space-efficient tools. So I tried to solve this problem in 2006 with version 2.0, which you may have never heard of before because I never actually distributed it because it didn't work. Well, it sort of worked, but it was a nightmare. This was my big attempt to make things radically simpler. It was suggested to me by a French user who had put together, again, Diogenes being open source, had put together his own version of Diogenes, which launched, it was a thing written just for a Mac, launched a Mac browser and started up Diogenes in the background. It was all in patch. I thought that was a really good idea. The idea was right, to have the client and the server in the same package so that the unsophisticated user has no idea that there are two aspects to the program there. But the power user can still take advantage of that by running the server on its own. So what I tried to do was to write an Apple web browser in Objective-C using the WebKit framework, which is basically Safari, and in Visual Basic using the .NET framework, which basically gives you a customized version of Internet Explorer. That's the first time in 20 years that I tried programming in a non-open source environment. And my God, what a nightmare. I'll never do it again. Yeah, I mean, this was like, you know, 100 lines of code in each case, but, you know, undocumented, buggy, impossible to predict how it was going to behave. And then you've got the point now of having to compile code on those two separate platforms before you can make a release, which, since I don't work on those platforms, is unrealistic. So I never actually released any of the version 2.0 versions because it would have meant me finding a Windows machine, that means borrowing my wife's laptop, finding an Apple machine, because I didn't have an Apple at that stage, so I have to get one of my colleagues to look to, can I use your office for a few minutes? I've got to compile my version of Diogenes for the Mac. It was just too much of a pain in the neck, so I never actually released it. So the moral here is that lots of platform-specific code is not the same as cross-platform code, which is what Diogenes has today. So I just maintain one set of code. It works on all three platforms. I wasn't there yet, but at least I was heading in the right direction. I did some more work on version 2.1, which again was never released, refactored the code into submodules. The web interface was a nightmare because it was my first ever web application and it was turned into spaghetti code, which any of you who've programmed will know what that means. It's just you can't follow the thread. I removed some of the stuff that wasn't really necessary, the on-the-fly LaTeX generation. I realized that was for a period before Unicode. Added some useful new features, marginal line numbering down the left-hand side, user-defined corpora, but that never got released. The release process was too complex. So unless you have slaves, make sure you can cut a release on one machine. You're not going to sit there and go yourself, machine to machine, recompiling code, unless you have other people to do that for you. So in 2007, with version 3.0, I tried a different approach. It's a new platform. I figured out that Mozilla might do what I wanted. This is the platform behind the Firefox web browser. So what I wrote was using Zool and JavaScript, a custom browser, which starts the server automatically, which is what those other things in the 2.0 version had done, the difference being that Mozilla does the hard work here of making sure that you've got binaries that work on all three different platforms. All of the binaries are downloaded from Mozilla. I don't compile anything myself, not even for my own platform, Linux. I take their binary packages, unpack it, put in Diogenes, repackage it, but never have to recompile anything. So all of this is done on a Perl script on my Linux machine, which means that just, you know, press one button and make a release, which means that if I have bug fixes, I can release them easily. The moral there is let someone else do the hard work of porting code to different platforms and take advantage of it. Version 3.1 then added some nice new functionality, the Perseus morphological data and dictionaries, rather than having to link to Perseus online, which was broken for a long time. Now all that comes with. I don't use any of the Perseus code that sits on my machine, and I just do massive pre-processing. So I run the morphological analysis over every word in the TLG, over every word in the PHI disk, and distribute the results, because that's easier, even though it results in gigabytes of data, it's easier than having to recompile the Perseus C code for every different platform. So again, take advantage of the fact that bandwidth and disk is cheap. It's a big download, but okay, it's half a gigabyte, you know, and that used to be a big deal, but it's not really anymore, I don't think. And it makes it a lot easier to maintain, because none of that is anything but pre-processed data. Added some Web 2.0 features, so the bit of the analysis and dictionary entry popping up on the side of the screen is all done using AJAX technology, so, you know, nice buzzword to throw in there. Unicode input, I've been meaning to add for a long time, but again, this is wasn't supported in many computers for a long time now. Unicode's pretty well entrenched, and so you can input Greek rather than in Latin transliteration, actually, as Greek. The moral there, it's easier to distribute data if you can get away with it than platform-dependent executables. Now, to the present. At the moment, I'm not doing any development work on Diogenes. I'm writing a book, so nothing's going to happen for another year or two, I guess. But I am fixing major bugs if anyone reports them. I'm collecting feature requests, so if you do have feature requests, please do send them in, and they'll get added to the to-do list. I was disappointed that I submitted the first version of Diogenes, version 1.4-something, to RAE 2001, and I assumed I'd be able to submit the new features for this last round of the RAE, but my university said no, because it would be a resubmission. I wrote a document explaining all of the new features. You know, it's software, it evolves. You know, these are pretty definite new features that have been added, and they said no. So it makes me wonder, really, how much effort I should put into improving Diogenes. And I suppose what I'm going to have to do, if I'm going to put any more effort into it, is to do what my friend in the statistics department called fig leaf publications. In other words, if you want to get a publication out of your software, write an article like this, what I've just done in front of you today, explaining what your software does, and submit that as a proxy output to the RAE. And keep your deans happy by getting grants. All of this Diogenes stuff was done on my own time without any support, and it works. I don't need the money, but if you're going to justify your existence to the powers that be, I think if I'm going to do any more development, I'm going to have to apply for money, and I'll find something to do with it, I'm sure. But the deans won't be happy unless I do that. So that is, I suppose, the biggest moral of Diogenes development. Don't commit suicide by just doing all of this stuff on your own. For the future, what are the problems right now? Most of my emails about Diogenes, now that it actually installs with one click quite easily, that used to be what my email was about, now I'm getting lots of email from the general public saying, I want to use this, but I don't have access to the CD-ROM databases. I've even got some emails from people in classics departments who don't have access to the CD-ROMs. You know, they're fragile things, and if you don't know the right people, I'm wondering, are they going to disappear eventually? Now the TLG is pushing people towards using their web interface. And the other big problem is you can't expand the corpus. You can't take text from different sources and put them all together. So the Perseus project have released all of their Greek and Latin texts under a Creative Commons license. It'd be nice if we will search them as well as the TLG and so forth. But so these are the problems. They could all be solved by having Diogenes output XML, which I guess is the next big step. That's obvious step. But how to do it? Do I do it internally? And have Diogenes, as it were, the server, spit out XML and have the client side convert it to HTML on the fly? Or do I make Diogenes convert the entire corpus in bulk into XML and write a new application which then works on the XML? I think I'm inching towards the latter solution. It'd actually be easy to port the Perseus stuff to a new application because I designed it that way, so that new application wouldn't be too hard to write. Could I use someone else's? Philologic is one possibility. I have to say, this is the University of Chicago project. I've tried fiddling with it, and it's not very user-friendly at the moment. Maybe it'll get better over the next few years. Who knows? Diogenes over Philologic has the advantage of a nice user interface, if I do say so myself, and easy installation compared to that. What are the licensing issues? I suppose if I just made a tool that allowed you to convert your TLG database in bulk to XML, it's not my business if people share it with their friends. You know, You can already get the TLG database via BitTorrent, as I sometimes hint to some of these people who email me and say they can't find the CD-ROMs. But that's not something I'm an expert on, licensing issues. I think fundamentally these ancient texts are the property of the West at large. I mean, they pre-exist copyright by several millennia, but one wants to do the right thing and not get into trouble. I think I've got right on my side, but whether one has the law on one side, well, again, if you leave it up to individuals to distribute these texts themselves, I think that would be one way of getting around it. So at the moment, I'm thinking about applying for grants in a couple of years to modify Diogenes to spit out these texts en masse in TEI conform and XML, and that's sort of where I'm heading. But I'm open to comments or suggestions from you. I hope that was not too dreadfully nerdy and technical, but hey, that's, I'm afraid, the subject, nature of the subject.
Thanks very much. There's a lot of things to think about. There are a lot of questions spring to mind a little bit. I'll throw it open to the floor first. Does anyone have any questions or comments to make?
Yes. When you were saying that you were sort of trying to do something, get something published, and you couldn't do it because it was too like the one you just published, couldn't you sort of publish that as a completely separate thing and then sort of add in the first one, parts of the first one, as some background information?
I did actually consider calling Diogenes version 3.1 a new name and saying, will you submit it now? Because I called it something different. It was a silly objection, and it actually all happened right just before the RE submission deadline. So even if I wanted to, there wasn't really time. But it's a problem that the RE does not really take into account software, particularly software. If you want software to be any good, it needs to evolve, it needs to add new features. It's not like, I think the model there that they're applying is a second edition of a monograph, which usually involves correcting a few errors, maybe responding to, you know, updating bibliography, responding to a few reviewers, but only minor changes, whereas this has had major rewrites. It's just the model doesn't really take that sort of thing into account. But I didn't really want to change the name of Diogenes because that's what people know it as, and that's what people refer other people to. It just all seemed very unfortunate.
And also, when you're talking about trying to distribute more, if you install something like, say, JAWS, there's a thing written into that where you can actually pass it on to five other people. So I don't know if anything like that could be sort of useful.
No. At the moment, one of the things I didn't mention is that I shifted from hosting it in my own university web space to SourceForge, which, just because it's such a large download, they've got mirrors all over the world, and so it's not putting a lot of stress on my university. I thought they might not like that if I just had it at one location, although I would have gotten better statistics if I just kept it on that.
That partly addresses one of my questions, which was, are you using SourceForge? But what I was actually asking is, are you using the SourceForge bug tracker and feature request tracker? You talk about getting emails with these things.
Yeah, they're not super user-friendly, I don't think. I mean, the SourceForge has a great idea, but some of their execution is not at least something to be desired. All I really use is their release management, which is basically just because it's such a large download. I mean, really, this is an open source project that really only has one developer. So I do source code management just for my own purposes, and it's in a form that could be distributed. I just don't see lots of other people doing that. Particularly since it's classicists, usually they're not giving you bug reports that are nice, self-contained. They just send you an email saying, help, it doesn't work. And then you have to email back and say, what platform are you using? What output are you expecting? And what are you getting? And what steps did you go through to get there? And eventually, you get a bug report out of that, but just having a bug reporting tool that people plug things into, particularly since it's only me that's going to be looking at it, I think is more trouble than it's worth. So I've got a to-do list, and I've got my email for bug reporting, and so far that's actually worked reasonably well. Yeah, mainly because it's a one developer model.
Sure.
The major reasons why, particularly for being recorded, you haven't said more about this than you have. But can I just ask you to say whatever you can say discreetly about your relations with the TLD? Because it seems to be the great bottleneck in all this is this dreadful legacy encoding that makes any tool designed to work on the TLG corpus have to jump through all kinds of hoops that in some cases have spikes around the rim. What the TLG need is for somebody to come along and actually churn out some usable XML versions of their corpus for the next generation. Mm. And so in a way, one would expect their interests and yours to coincide. But of course, they're also very tough about licensing issues. And one of the things that your future plans absolutely violate their license in proposing to do is to take the existing corpus and to redistribute it in a different form. Mm. And unless you have some kind of rapprochement with them that recognizes the mutual benefit of this, then that could be quite a shizzle.
There's several questions there. My relationship with the TLG is non-existent. I mean, when I first published Diogenes, I expected them to put a reference to it up on their page of software, because it's the only thing that worked on Linux, for one thing, regardless of whether it was better or worse than the other options. But as far as I know, they never have done so. And so, in some way, I've approached this entirely as an outsider. I've gotten to know the Perseus people a bit, who've been very, very cooperative and helpful, but they don't have a model where their revenue stream is dependent on people paying them for access, which is a really problematic model for classicists in general, I think, because it, they've done some great things, but it also kind of entrenches their interests in a way that don't necessarily correspond with the interests of people who want to do interesting and creative things with these texts. I believe that internally they've already converted all of their stuff to XML. I mean, there's some reference on their website that's, it's like, reading the hieroglyphs on their website. What are they actually doing internally there? I think they've already done that, but they're not publishing that, and that's the problem. So that's good for them, but for the rest of us, all we have is their web interface to the newer texts. And again, is their web interface perfect? Does it make mistakes in searching? Well, you can't use another search program, so you can't double check your results, which is one of the original reasons I wrote Diogenes, because I think you should always. I mean, I still use Pandora if I'm going to publish something, relying on a particular result, or I'll gin up a quick script that specifically tests for that. I always want to double check your things that you're going to publish about your data. There are only two examples of this work. Check it. But you can't do that now with the way the TLG is set up. So unfortunately, I don't know how to make their interests align with classicists' interests, because I think because of their revenue model, they're stuck in this very rigid attitude where there are texts and you can only do with them what we tell you to do, which is a problem if they haven't foreseen some wonderful thing that you want to do with those texts. So I have no relationship with them, and actually, I think by and large, don't wish to have one, just judging from their attitude in general towards collaboration and openness.
Well, I mean, to a couple of them, one thing to be said in the defense is that they're quite delicate licensing issues with copyright owners on the editions.
I don't know. I've heard that copyright lawyers would laugh in your face if you suggested that an edition of a text stripped of introduction apparatus had any copyright status at all, an ancient text. I think it's not as clear as all of that. I mean, and the license for the PHI text explicitly says, we did not digitize the apparatus because we did not want to have to depend on the copyright of that information. It doesn't say that it's free of copyright. The other stuff is free of copyright, but it specifically says we have only digitized the text because we didn't want to get involved with copyrights of modern information, which suggests that the PHI actually believe that no copyright applies to the ancient texts themselves. It's a wonderful paradox, because if you think about it from the point of view of a copyright lawyer and the point of view of a textual critic, for a copyright lawyer, something has copyright only if it has original, only if it's original, not if it's derivative of something else. But for a textual critic, the more original thought you put into the problem, the closer you're getting to the original text. So instead of originality being something completely different from dependency, for a textual critic, they're actually, in a sense, the same thing, which copyright law doesn't doesn't have a way of accounting for, as far as I know. I'm not a lawyer, as one always has to say.
No, I think you're right that the TLG aren't going to have much interest in this particular approach for the reasons you described, primarily the financial, but also the licensing reasons. You might just thought you might have more luck approaching the PHI people who don't have the same issue. Their stuff is licensed, but they no longer make money by licensing out their CDs because they have their stuff freely available online. So that might be a more problem. I know they are doing interesting and new things with their texts.
Yeah, with the inscriptions.
With the inscriptions.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that might be a more problem.
I suspect maybe their attitude would reflect that license, where they clearly imply their attitude but don't say anything explicitly because they don't want to get into trouble. No one wants to get into trouble. That's the thing.
The third data set that you mentioned, the Duke Data Bank documentary inquiry, is as you know, but I don't know if everybody knows, is no longer locked into the beta code format that it was when it was on the PHI CD. It's now in TI-XML, and so long as our program has fixed the problem that we just spotted with it this afternoon, it will all be freely available this coming Monday to the world. So I mean that's
a great thing. Have there been licensing issues with that?
No.
No.
It's all been assumed to be freely available. I mean, The added value that they've put into it by marking it up is copyrighted by the text themselves. Yeah, the author's been dead for well over 70 years. So that they're all available Creative Commons. You don't need to ask permission. You don't need us to generously say, would you like a copy of these texts? You can just take them as soon as they're made available online. But you know, if you'd like access to more about those texts and more information about the way they're encoded or whatever, we'd I know for a fact that the people directly responsible for it, which doesn't include me, although I've been involved in the programming side of it, would be more than happy to have all sorts of dialogues about that.
Yeah.
I think that would be very useful. It doesn't necessarily help with the Greek and Latin literary texts, because there aren't equivalents for them, except for the Perseus ones.
Yeah. I mean, I think I will probably work on the Latin text, because those are the ones I'm particularly interested in. I've been in touch with Neil Smith, who has a devious plan of, which he's going to run by copyright lawyers, to generate minimally marked up XML texts of some of the PHI texts. And I think, he's the one who's talking to the copyright lawyers, but he's trying to solve this problem anyway. The fundamental issue is that the text itself, it's not subject to copyright. I mean, Homer doesn't belong to anyone.
No, absolutely. The difficulty is, of course, copyright lawyers can't actually answer that question.
Mm.
Only when it goes to court.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that makes it difficult.
Sure.
But anyway.
Have you had any dealings with the Toynbee?
I've only used their interface for it. I mean, yes, it's really dreadful. But hey, dreadful software. It's not it's everywhere. The great thing about it is that it's not chronologically limited the way the PHI one is, which ends strictly at the year 200 AD, except bizarrely for Servius, which, I mean, I'm glad that they put in Servius, but why didn't they put in Macrobius? It doesn't make any sense to include one and not include the other. Other authors who might possibly be Christian, but surely have to be included as part of a classical corpus, Claudian, Ammianus, they're all excluded from the PHI text. You can get those on the Teubner text, and that's the only reason I've ever used it, to get access to those particular people. But, I mean, they have, if I recall correctly, I mean, I think they've encrypted the texts, and so, one could probably reverse engineer it, but whether it's worth doing is, given that the PHI is there and just a few texts short. I think the way we want to move is to a situation where you can throw together texts from very diverse sources. This is not a pipe dream with the text encoding initiative promoting people to use the same standards for markup. And you take your Perseus text, you take some other text that maybe you've gotten from the TLG, you take text that you've gotten from other places, maybe from Toyber, put them all together and use one search program to search them all. That should be possible if everyone just lets go of their data a little bit, and that would be the ideal situation. That way you could also search multiple editions of the same text, which is something that the PHI and TLG have strictly ruled out, even when there is no standard edition of a particular text and there's a lot of controversy over which edition. So for example, the PHI texts include Gould's Propertius, which is hardly a generally accepted text of that author.
Found the user supports to be a large consumer of your time, because I'm curious about this partly because if you can't submit a new version of a software for the RAD, you certainly can't submit all the things that support the user.
Yeah, I guess the thing is with the programming, I can just do that in small bursts occasionally, as I've always done, just added things to the to-do list. But the support requests come in real time, and people want, well, I mean, they don't demand, but that, you know, if it's going to be useful, the response has to be prompt, regardless of whether you've got lectures to write or other things on your mind. So, I mean, my ability to support users is very patchy, and it kind of depends on how busy I am at the time, and how clearly they express their problem, because sometimes if you know it's going to be three emails before you even get an idea of what the problem is and I'm busy, well, it's just not going to happen. But I do try to support users when I can, and sometimes that does involve a lot of hand-holding and solving problems that are not strictly related to this piece of software and so forth. So it's just, I mean, fortunately, Classics is a small enough community that even if you're doing that for classes all around the world, it's not going to take up too much of your time, but it does take up time. I have to say a lot less now that I've made a one-click install on all three platforms, because installation issues are always the biggest problem.
It does seem to me that being so ignorant of this, entirely ignorant of this, that it didn't conform to the pattern I had in my mind of open source and Linux work. But I sort of felt that somebody started it, then after that a community of interaction occurred a great deal.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you were a single developer model. And that again, surprised me. It thinks to me, in a way, it could have been a snowball, all kinds of people coming in, and you wouldn't have each time have to do far than they would work.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. In an ideal world, I wish it would work out that way. From the point of view of the programming, well, there just aren't that many classicist programmers around. And from the point of view of user support, well, again, I mean, the level of technological know-how is not widely available among classicists. I mean, open source software began with highly skilled technical users for the sort of software that they use themselves. It's harder to generalize that model to something where most of your users don't have a technical background. I certainly, well, you do get people, you know, sharing solutions on mailing lists and so forth. One of the things that my model has not done well is I've got lots of people who've sent in various questions, but I don't tend to put them on a frequently asked questions list or something like that. And so I think one thing I could do more of would be to have some sort of more general forum where people ask questions, where maybe other people could shout in with answers. I'm not sure what the best way of doing it. I gave some thought to it at some point, and I couldn't quite figure out what the best way of doing that was, so I sort of gave up on it. But maybe I should think about that again, possibly just hosting my own discussion list locally, because again, SourceForge has facilities for doing that, which are very clunky.
Yeah.
But I did look into using that, and they just didn't seem to work very well. So, and that's a good idea.
The other thing that occurs to me on that note is that you want, I mean, once this tool becomes a tool that can be used to query XML files of these texts, generally that don't specifically have to be from any of the CD-ROMs.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'll want to be looking at other open source tools that are, again, specifically targeted at classical texts that do this sort of thing. The one that springs to my mind is the Papyrological Navigator, which again should be published next week, which is open source and has been created to do exactly this with the Duke Data Bank Document Repository, but you know, will work with other TEI texts.
Mm. Yeah, so there's no reason at all to have two separate things that do that. So ideally, we merge them together. Well, maybe, yeah.
There could be a lot of reasons to have two tags, but any code you can share between the two, it would be a good idea.
Definitely. I mean, and people do make modifications for their own purposes, even if they're not generally useful. I just got an email this week from someone in Slovenia who had modified Diogenes. Instead of using LSJ, it used a Greek-Slovenian dictionary of his own authorship instead. And interestingly, he'd modified it for his students so that instead of having the read-only Greek texts on the left and the Perseus data dictionary and morphological analysis on the right, he made the left pane a pane that you can type into. So for students doing their Greek homework, I guess he's having them doing Greek prose composition, you're using Diogenes as a spell checker, because you're able to click on each word and it gives a morphological analysis, and obviously if there's no analysis, then probably the student's made a mistake and has put the wrong form in. So that's certainly a use I had never thought of for it, but because it's open source, people can make those sorts of local changes, and whether that's generally useful enough to be worth distributing, I don't know if Greek prose composition spell checkers is something that the world is clamoring for, but possibly. And many of the modifications to Diogenes have come as a result of user requests, and in some cases people have contributed code, which I haven't used because it hasn't really fit in with the programming style, but I've gotten the idea from that and said, I'll integrate that feature in my own way.
Of course, it was always possible to, effectively, Pandora was probably open source because it was written in HyperCard.
Yeah.
And it was, and actually had hacked it, certainly.
Yes.
Like the transition 6. there were certain things that didn't, on which there were limits in the distributed version, which you had to hack to remove those limits. And Aeon's mess around with the X and D's, but the HyperCard.
The problem was that the HyperCard platform itself was slow. The model that they were using of doing all the citation info as you searched is necessarily slow. Certainly it was, for its time, a pretty good application. And in fact, after the first public release of Diogenes, the guy who had been hired to program, I announced it on Fresh Meat, which is a website for new open source projects. And the guy who'd been the original programmer, not a classicist, just someone who'd been hired to do it, sent me an email saying, good luck, Pandora probably is getting a bit long in the tooth, so good to see something else coming out to take its place.
Comments here and eventually lead to a question. But I tried to use Pandora once, or maybe twice. In King's, we actually had it installed on, I think, one of the research computer room. And nobody ever told me I needed to go to the departmental office and get a CD and use LR. This probably explains why I could never work it. And so I sort of gave up trying to do any sort of electronic searching until one day when I was library upstairs, one of my dodgy Greek friends who had all the pirated stuff gave me a copy of PHI in Museus. Had a look back. But being a Latinist, it was very, very simple on that. But I can remember trying to install Diogenes then, so several years ago, and having problems installing it on a Windows machine. But the thing that you start off with at the very beginning about doing comparative searches in different software, to me, was very, very instinctive. And I always used to go and double check that in Perseus.
Yeah.
And mine was Hermetic, so it's quite easy. I didn't have to worry about your Greek stuff. When I started Metamorphosis, I got a copy of the text, a text version from my tutors, and it just reminded me through a recording program. And I'd give me free checks while having it in plain sure. But I can say that I didn't have those needs on my office machine when I installed it the other day in the week. Very, very simple. I was straight to my I found the disk of PHI and dropped it on. And you don't need the disk, you just need to copy it over. But at the very, very beginning, something you were talking about, something that Gabby and I were talking about the other day, and that's the fact that people don't cite the mechanism by which they've done these searches because they're not acknowledging that they're correct. out of the entire corpus as fast as you can. The only way you can do it effectively efficiently is by electronic means. Does anybody actually cite diode means? How did you get them to cite it? Because that would really, really help. If people are actually saying, I'm using this, this is how I'm obtaining the
cite. Because if you don't cite it, what you're effectively doing is you're claiming, you're implicitly making the pretense that you know all of Greek and Latin literature so well that you just picked this fact, this stuff up. Which most of us do, of course.
Yeah.
Or you actually went through the entire works of Cicero word by word, looking for this combination of words.
Some people do. I mean, I was pleased but also appalled recently to open up Steve Hayward's Cynthia's companion to his OCT of Propertius, and he does specifically cite the edition of Pandora that he's using and the edition of the PHI CD-ROM, but I was like, you know, I know him, we're both working on Propertius, he's our external examiner, surely I could have helped him out here. We've never actually talked about it. If he's, you know, still using Pandora, he could do something a lot faster. He switched to Diogenes. But yes, there are some people who do it, and I'm mystified as to why more people don't, and I also don't know how to get them to do it. Some people will cite the edition of the CD-ROM without citing the software they use, which again throws the question of, did you sit there and read the CD yourself by hand, or what tool did you use? But it's, I guess, a culture thing. People who aren't technologically sophisticated tend to take these things for granted, and maybe, just, it's there. I don't understand it, I don't know how it works. But really, I mean, a scholar should be able to get around their head around the idea that
right.
you've got to cite the source of your information.
You then go to the library and get your OCT text out and actually check it against that. And then the citation would go to that. But you need, of course, you cite
the actual printed volume for the text itself. But for your claim that there are three instances of this in Cicero, that you didn't get from the text itself, that's the sort of thing you need to cite elsewhere.
Well, the root of the problem here is that people are not aware that the T-body is broken. When it came along, it was such a gobsmacking tool, even running on this sort of freaky Ipicus machine. To this day, I'm sure the majority of classes are completely unaware that there is anything unreliable about using any search tool whatever on particularly the CD-ROM corpora. Once they know that, they're going to be conscious of it. But if there isn't a culture of saying in your preface, let's say otherwise all text searches were carried out in Diogenes and checked against Pandora 2.5.3, then the message isn't going to get distributed.
Yeah.
I think people are aware, most people I think are aware that the TLG, however they use it, isn't entirely reliable. But
the people you talk to, because you go and spend
all that time. No, I think most of people are aware that they can't trust it absolutely. I mean, they will always, for example, go to the printed volume to check that the text is right. And so if the text might be wrong, then the search might be wrong. But I think the problem partly is that you don't think of the search engine as a research tool. You think of it as just a tool. When you go to look for a book in the library, you search on the library catalogue, you then get the book off the shelf, you don't cite the library catalogue, you have to find it. So they think of a web search engine as the same, they think of Wikipedia as the same, they think of Pandora or Diogenes in the same way. They haven't stopped to think that this is actually doing some of my intellectual work for me.
Mm.
And therefore, I'm actually shooting myself in the foot by not citing it, because if it makes a mistake, I get the blame.
Yeah.
But they don't think of it in those terms. And that's an education thing. I think if our students make that mistake, it's our fault.
Can I just sort of tease out the larger narrative? Because there is an extraordinary story here which you've been very modest about actually sort of indicating his actual plans. But it speaks volumes about the nature, the institutional structures of our profession, that a lone spare time coder can produce what is now effectively the universal tool for a kind of activity that all philologists do. And in the teeth of an existing massively funded institutional behemoth that has its own sort of team of highly paid people who are doing it full time, and you know, decades of history behind it, and nevertheless, I mean, it's clear to anyone who is using this corpus that Diogenes is your tool of choice, that it has leapfrogged everything that everyone has ever designed from within the TLG system. And that seems an extraordinary state of affairs. I mean, it's a great sort of heroic narrative, but I mean, it's just a truly bizarre situation in relation to planet. A doctoral student can sort of hack around in Linux in spare time and actually come up with something that is more worthwhile than all these movies.
Well, thank you very much. I should have had you give this narrative, historical narrative. It would have been much more exciting. You know, the one man against the world. Sometimes I did feel a bit like that, but I did think that what I was doing needed to be done. And I've hidden it here, but I'm a true believer in free software. And I think that closed source, non-free software is immoral, fundamentally. And so there is a sort of a drive for me behind this. I have my own motivations for doing it. As to why the massively funded institutions don't do a better job, things are changing somewhat. There's been a shift of somewhat of a cultural shift towards the funding bodies realizing that unless you make things open license, Creative Commons license or whatever, you could be throwing you're throwing your money into building an institution that has no interest in actually collaborating, because that diminishes their power. And so it's really the funding bodies that have to ensure that if we're going to give you lots of money, you are going to have your output in such a form that you can collaborate with other people that we're funding, because otherwise all we're doing is building up one monopoly which has no incentive to do things better than the next guy, because you know they're the only game in town. And so you know, Perseus distributing all of its stuff on a Creative Commons license is a great step forward, because they're kind of a flagship operation, and it would be wonderful to see that same sort of pressure being put on the TLG to say, well, how come you're not open sourcing all of your attacks? I don't know, if they get most of their money from classics departments, maybe then it is us that need to be making that statement, saying if you're going to be charging and some of their licensing fees for rich institutions that are apparently enormous, if you're going to be charging exorbitant fees, well, we want to see some progress on bringing your operation to the way that we're all operating now, which is on the basis of data that can be shared and collaborated on.
I have to say that I'm sure that's a deserved compliment, but I must give you a criticize you. I'd like to say, in the Palatinate, it may be reasonable to say it, but here we have to say person against the world.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the real problem, I guess, with these non-free tools is that they cost money to create. They have their own structure and their funding structure. If they didn't charge, they wouldn't be able to continue to exist in the way that they do and continue to grow in the way that they do. And regardless of what anyone may think about the way they work and the way they're run, at the moment they have sufficiently cornered the market that departments are willing to pay thousands of dollars a year for the side license.
Yep.
And that at the end of the day is what would have to change before any something else changed.
So the question there is, do they have to grow? Do they have to continue? If your goal is to create a digital corpus of all Greek literature, there is an endpoint there. You know, and when you've reached that endpoint, what don't you shut yourself down? Of course, human institutions don't tend to shut themselves down. They tend to find reasons to carry on. Hence, the TLG is digitizing further and further and further. They'll be on modern Greek literature, I'm sure, in another decade because
they already have 18th century texts.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not just a question of dark chronic compass. It's also a question of the quality of editions. And for something like the dramatists, the TLG is virtually useless because it's still working with good or poor best available texts of the tragedians and specialists. What one would have hoped to have seen by 2008 is a lot more of the bringing of the current state of the art edition, the one that everyone is using, into the corpus.
We have multiple editions. Hey, I mean, you know, there are lots of authors for which there is not one clear-cut winner, and the people have their choices. Why can't you choose, you know, whose Propertius you want, you know, or whatever? Surely that's something you do all the time as a classicist. You're either going to pull down the Toivonen or you can pull down the OCT. It's a personal choice, and in some cases it doesn't matter very much, but in some cases it matters a great deal. And it just seems like an obvious step forward, yet the infrastructure of the TLG has never allowed for that. Likewise with apparatus criticae. I mean, why don't we have this? If they're actually working with the publishers, and presumably some of our money we're paying on license fees is going to the publishers, why can't we have the apparatus as well?
It would be a very interesting markup or a design exercise to try and work out how you would encode it.
There's lots of guidelines from the TEI on how to do exactly that, yeah. So it's technologically quite feasible. And as you say, they're massively funded, so they could solve this problem if they really wanted to, if they had some incentive to solving the kinds of problems that I think a lot of classicists would be delighted to see them solve. Then I think they could crack that nut quite easily.
Even if it's not marked up, having the apparatus just available, searchable, just gets you more hits for words that may not be the word in the text. I think Greg Crane makes the argument that if you OCR a page of Greek text from an edition, and you omit the apparatus, you're losing 7% of the Greek words you'll get on that page.
Yep.
If you keep the apparatus, the OCR only has, so that's what you're getting from the TLG or from any of these other sites. The OCR has, you know, a 2-3% error rate, but the text that has been properly entered and proofread or whatever has 7% of the words missing because there's nothing from the apparatus. So actually just OCRing the whole page, including the apparatus criticus, halves your error rate.
I think I buy Greg Crane's argument that in the future the way we're going to search Greek text is the way Google presents its searches, which is that they've done automatic optical character recognition on not just one edition but 10 different editions. So even if they've got a 5% error rate, they're going to pick up that word on one of those editions,
right.
And then you click on it, and instead of having to mark it up, all they do is they show you an image of the page, and then you can work from that. And if it's properly cross-linked, then you could link to that page in another edition and double-check it against various editions and read the apparatus. And that is feasible now. It's quite straightforward to do, provided you've got the money, like as Google does, to actually get all these editions and get libraries to cooperate and do it. And would solve an awful lot of these problems, including getting the apparatus in there. So that's his vision, and it is whether it's going to happen soon. I think probably it will happen. So I think that all hope's not lost, but I don't think the TLG is necessarily the future, just because the direction they're going, you know, towards modern Greek, I don't think it's much interest to many classicists.
Well, I mean, the Google vision, of course, is that of brute power being used to search rather than any kind of semantics. Even if the text is semantically marked up in any way or structurally marked up in any way, they lose that. All they do is they look at string recognition.
Yeah.
And that's all they do. And they get, you know, they get powerful enough results, you know, by a combination of that and data mining and various other things that they can get results. I mean, for web page results, you know, that is the tool that everybody uses. So yeah, it may well be that turns out to be a more useful way to query than doing it in a more semantic way.
In some ways, it has its disadvantages, but I mean, the fact is that you can actually see Google sitting down and doing this, and in 2 months, they could have all of Greek literature scanned in lots of different editions. Even if we just stuck to out-of-copyright editions, you'd still probably have enough overlap there that you've got something that you could use as a tool in lieu of the TLG. You know, again, be losing some things, you wouldn't have the most up-to-date editions. If you had a big operation behind it, they could maybe get the publishers in line, and you could have recent editions searchable in that way as well. You know, maybe not showing the whole page, but just saying that there's a hit here, so you need to go look at the text. It's feasible if someone or some company puts their effort behind it. It can be done quite straightforwardly, quite quickly.
Any other questions or comments, observations, arguments?
Just been reminded of one thing, and that's by the closure of the ICS library in CERN. And this is a little anecdote from a professor of classics in the University of London, who emailed me 2 years ago. So the ICS library is closing, so I borrowed their PHI disk, but it doesn't work. Sorry. Something missing, the software to explain it.
And you wonder why we have difficulty getting classes to cite the particular version of the software they're using. They don't even realize that you need software to search.
I take issue, by the way, with your comment earlier that there are very few class assists in the program. Only because, for a purely something centrist point of view, the digital classes mailing list alone is probably about 200.
Yeah.
So I suspect.
I mean, I would like to think that if I get hit by a bus as we're heading to the pub, that someone would pick up the code base and Diogenes and maintain it. I mean, at this point, it's been 10 years, and there's some of that code that I would be going back and reading for the first time. I mean, I wouldn't have any enormous advantage over someone who is a neophyte. I think that's obviously one of the big advantages, even if you don't have a large group of people maintaining something, because there's the overhead of getting up to speed with the code. But, you know, if the developer does disappear, then, someone else can put in that time, get up to speed with it, and carry it forward. I'm sure that would happen, but it's not as though it would be worth someone's while to get up to speed just so that they could be the me when I happen not to be around, if you see what I mean. Yeah.
No, sure. But just, little, and no one's at this point going to turn around and pick up the whole thing and try and run it all again, but if someone wants to write a little plugin for it, a little adaptation to it. I do know two communities of... one of classicists specifically, the other which is Google classicists, who do use the issue tracker in SourceForge for managing feature requests and that sort of thing.
Maybe I should look at it again. I just noticed this week that they have
It's not the most ideal. I've never liked issue trackers, any issue tracker I've ever seen very much for this sort of thing. But if you're a programmer, you're used to it. I mean, yes, the classicist who can't make it work isn't going to use mechanism, but a programmer who's saying, well, actually, I know what I want done to this.
That's true.
They might use it. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to predict how much of a community would build up about this sort of thing if you started using community tools. I mean, it may be that there's a dozen of these people on digital classes would all get involved, which would be a dream.
Yeah.
It may be that no one would. It would be you, and then there'd be two irritating people sending you feature requests. I might just send it as an email.
Yeah.
So,
maybe we'll try.
If there are no other immediate questions or comments, but perhaps we should thank you once again.